Thank you for listening to me. This has been a great therapy session. How often do you come across things like this that where customers just say like, whoa, we didn't think it was going to cost money to do an engineering analysis of our building? Hey, this is Forrest with the Concrete Conversations podcast. We are dedicated to helping the average Joe become the above average pro. And today we talked with a very above average pro, Nick Heim, professional engineer. He's a civil engineer, a structural engineer, a sanitation engineer, a quality engineer. There are a few different types of engineering that he invented because he's that much of an amazing engineer. Don't tell him I said that. But anyway, Nick Heim was fantastic. We talked about everything from old school, the back of the napkin, pen and paper, run some calculations type of engineering, all the way to the kind of high-tech stuff that a lot of engineers are doing today with softwares and non-destructive testing equipment, all sorts of great stuff. It was really interesting. We also talked about one of the favorite topics on our show, which is the helping guys come up in the industry here, helping the new average Joes become that above average pro. And Nick has a lot of experience with being mentored, and now he's a great mentor for others who are coming up. You should definitely be following Nick Heim on LinkedIn and, you know, not stalking the guy, but definitely following. Listen to the podcast episode. You'll find out why. Hey, so Nick, thank you so much for being on the podcast today. It's great to have you here on the Concrete Conversations podcast. Nick, we've got a burning question for you. It's about engineering. Nick, true or false, you know something about engineering?
True.
Okay, amazing. All right, you must be well qualified to answer this question then. Nick, as you, I, and everybody else knows, in the ancient world, there's evidence of engineering all over the place. There are a whole bunch of people in what country? It was like Jordan or Syria, or maybe it was Israel. I don't remember. One of those countries over there, they built these big pyramids. Don't remember where that was. But anyway, there are big pyramids that were built. There were aqueducts built in like Greece or France or something. All sorts of engineering folk in the ancient world. Considering how old that profession is, how resistant or amenable to change is that profession, generally speaking? Is this a, look, we've been doing this for thousands of years, and we've been doing it one particular way, and we just kind of like doing that? Or is it more like, holy cow, we love new stuff, let's do new stuff? Like the guys who built the original pyramids, maybe those things were crappy, and then they built some nicer pyramids. They're like, wow, look at that, that's the cat's pajamas, we like these new pyramids. So how does engineering like change?
Us engineers, Forrest, we do not like change.
Okay. Unpack that for me. What kind of change do you engineers hate the most?
I think a lot of it comes down to there's a way that's been proven. We know that it works. And through our training and just the general nature of the profession, we are very conservative people for good reason. I would say that it's not so much that we're completely opposed to it. We need to be convinced. And I know we're gonna talk about a little bit of that on the technology side today too.
Yeah. Yeah. So there's the technology part of this. Okay. So I have, I'm not an engineer, but, I haven't even played one on TV, but I know guys who are engineers, and these guys, all of them that I know, are all very, proficient, very comfortable and familiar with computers and lots of different very high-end software, softwares that they use for all sorts of stuff, like designing pyramids, probably. And they have to use that stuff all the time. Are there any real old-school guys that you know of who are still like, give me a pen, give me some graph paper and a calculator or an abacus, whatever, and let me go about it that way? Are there old school guys who are still doing that, or are they all kind of on the software and computer train in varying degrees?
Absolutely. There are people I know that are still to this day don't really get into the computer software a whole lot, and they're designing buildings by hand. Now, I'd say they're pretty few and far between, and I'll just say this right now. There's nothing wrong with doing it the old school way. And in fact, it's one of the best ways to learn before you actually throw yourself at the computer and be subject to something that you know, you may not be able to prove completely or takes a long time to do. And as engineers, we have ways to double check, right, results from a computer, structural analysis software to make sure the back of the napkin, as we call it, actually jives with what the computer's putting out. And then there's also, if you've been doing it long enough, there's what we call engineering judgment, where you kind of get a feel for how things should be, what numbers are coming out of the computer, etc. So there are still people who love to do it by hand, but again, nothing wrong with keeping it old school.
Yeah, no, I don't have any problem with that at all. I think that's really important to be able to keep those skills, basically in our collective societal memory. Otherwise, my personal opinion is if we outsource everything, all thinking to computers and all tasks of all nature to computers, then we just kind of forget how to do that. And I think that puts us in a bad place. So yeah, I think that's really cool. What kind of checks are there that are in place that are standard in the engineering world? Are they the same checks that would be applied to somebody doing it on the back of a napkin as if they're doing it, you know, all 100% in AutoCAD or somewhere in Autodesk? Are there double checks that are, hey, I did this, coworker next door, take a look at this, make sure there's nothing wrong here. What's standard there?
It's going to depend firm to firm, but the first place you're going to look is, right, the codes and building standards, which the way I like to describe them essentially is our collective knowledge of hundreds or thousands of engineers that have come together, sitting on code committees, taking a lot of time and energy out of their careers to put these together for practicing engineers throughout the country. In this case, we'll stick to just the U.S. standards. So, and that's what software is based on, right? These building codes and all the equations, et cetera, that come from it. So there's going to be checks internal to the software. It may tell you that, you know, you have like a boundary condition that doesn't appear to be right or an instability. But on the human side, and it will depend firm to firm, there is almost always a peer review process. And the way I was brought up in consulting is you as, right, the project engineer might, right, run package, calcs, whatever the case may be, and your project manager is your kind of first initial checker. And then there's a project principal above him that oversees the entire thing and is ultimately the one that's putting their engineering stamp on the work product. So you typically have one to two layers, I would say, of checks and balances to make sure that ultimately what's going out the door is done to a certain company standard and the standards of the industry.
So is there any correlation between software proficiency and professional competency? Or can be professional competency be completely separate from software proficiency?
It's the latter. So as a professional, I think the good engineers, and I think many would agree that if you know what you're doing by hand, right, the engineering mechanics, the judgment, first principles, going back to just, right, statics, you can figure out the software along the way. But if you are starting off first and foremost as just somebody who's, let's say, good on the sticks, good on the keyboard, and you kind of miss all that stuff I talked about first, it doesn't really work the other way around. But I think most engineers are very, very intelligent people. They can figure out, say, like a standard software analysis package. Where I think it starts to get a little tricky is when you start introducing stuff that may not be as standard or within their wheelhouse.
Yeah, you know, there's it's really interesting, this topic of engineers, or just anybody in a STEM profession, I suppose, doing things kind of an old school way versus a new high technology methodology. And because I think about the kind of the national, I don't know if this is an international conversation, but it's definitely a national conversation of what role does higher education play in one's one's professional success, one's vocational success. And the answer is that we've found that there's a far weaker correlation than previously assumed. When I grew up, I was explicitly told this, that if you don't go to college, don't get at least a four-year degree, you should get real comfortable in just being a cashier your whole life, because that's probably about as much as you're going to be able to do. And I know that's not true. Most of us know that that's not the case. But there are a lot of professions that really don't require a four-year degree. And every time that I've talked to anybody about this topic, I always say, you know, engineering is probably one of those that I'd like an engineer to go to a fair amount of school and get a lot of training, because I drive over the bridge that he designs and I take an elevator up to the top floor of the building that he builds in, you know, on paper or in the software first. Is there any difference of that in that with that conversation, that national conversation about the relevancy of higher education as it pertains to engineers?
I'd say it rarely comes up. I think if you speak to most engineers, whether licensed or not, there's some agreement that some form of schooling is required. And I'll say, from getting the time I spent studying to get my license, what you actually come across is you can actually get licensed with less than a four-year degree. It just changes how much experience you need prior to sitting for the test. Because as we know, right, real world experience is very valuable, but I do think higher education serves a pretty critical role in that foundation that you need to be successful as an engineer. And I'll just say, right, what did I learn in engineering school? I learned how to read and write, like, more critically than you would think would be for an engineer. Those are two that I put pretty high up the list, right? Basic statics, fundamentals of engineering, but also, right, how to work in a team environment, right? Managing time, deadlines, a lot of skills that you don't really think about is like going into an engineering curriculum and getting, but that ultimately end up being pretty important for work in the profession.
I think that's great. What I'm interested in this topic that you and I were discussing earlier before we recorded about technology and what the roles that technology is playing in the engineering industry. And maybe we should specify here that there are, you know, what engineering is. There are sanitation engineers, and there are janitorial engineers, and, you know, a lot of different professions have taken on the title of fill-in-the-blank engineer. How would you define engineering based off of your experience and your education?
It's about problem solving. That's really as simple as it gets. It's about problem solving. Now, from a legal perspective, there's some sort of licensure, right? Because there are a lot of great problem solvers that I know that aren't engineers, right? We could say, right, non-destructive testing technicians coming more from your world, Forrest, contractors, right, field technicians in our world, all great people who have problem-solving skills that maybe wouldn't be, you know, we wouldn't call them engineers. So is it an aspect of there's some sort of math or calculation or analysis and thinking, I think, are all things that go into being an engineer. And then, like I said, there's the legal definition of an engineer, and you can go to your, you know, your state's or jurisdiction's code or handbook, and like what defines a professional engineer. And I can't really think of the, you know, full definitions off the top of my head, but that's kind of it in a nutshell.
Yeah. So your background personally is civil and structural engineering, correct?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so how those are, I guess I'm a little surprised. Maybe I shouldn't be, because those seem like dissimilar fields of engineering. Correct me if I'm wrong. How did you get into both civil and structural engineering?
So at most universities here in the U.S., so structural engineering is like a subset or a sub-focus of the broader, like, civil engineering. So you would enroll, like, to take classes in civil engineering, be part of a civil engineering department, and then as you get into the later half of your career, your third and fourth years, then you would be specializing in classes in structural engineering. So they're similar in that structural kind of falls under civil, and it's very similar when you go to apply for a PE in the States, where civil and structural licensure aren't necessarily separate, which we could get into later, but they kind of go hand in hand.
Hmm. That's interesting. You know, my first experience with a structural engineer was on a project years ago where I was doing a ground penetrating radar investigation. It was on concrete. There was a, I don't remember if it was a residential, it was some building, a foundation got poured, and they still hadn't erected the building, but they had skipped or somehow missed the rebar inspection. And so there was rebar in that concrete, or so they say, and the county was telling them that you had two choices. One, to either get some sort of a non-destructive testing evaluation, or two, rip it out and replace and get a rebar verification. And so obviously they opted for the former rather than the latter. So I went out and I scanned it to figure out where that rebar is and write a report and such. But one of the stipulations that the county has, and this is the only time this has ever happened. I've done, I don't know how many hundreds of these, but they said, we want a structural engineer to be there on site with you to oversee the work. And I said, well, he doesn't know how to do this. I mean, we can bring a structural engineer out, but I mean, the structural engineer, I mean, we'll give our reports to structural engineers, but I mean, he doesn't really know a whole lot about ground penetrating radar, and he's just going to be kind of standing there watching us. I mean, you want him to stand there and watch us? Yep, we want him on site, standing there and watching you. And so the structural engineer had to bring his fee into this as well, and he literally stood there and watched me and asked a bunch of questions about what I was doing because he'd never seen it before. And I gave him my report, and then he threw his cover letter on it and charged the customer a whole bunch of money, and that was my first experience with using structural engineers being involved with a structural engineer. And it seemed to me as silly, but I'm also very open to hearing, to understanding why, like, actually, Forrest, it's a really good idea for that to have happened for this, and this reason. Educate me or laugh with me, whichever one applies here, Nick.
And it's hard to say without knowing the specifics of the project, but let's go over a couple of examples of how this went, right? You could have been out there with him, right? He's got, assuming this was the engineer of record, he was the one who designed the foundation, right? So he's got his set of construction documents, and he's talking through with you, trying to understand, hey, is what you're finding as the GPR technician lining up with what I specified as the structural engineer? And maybe he took your report, you know, and said, hey, this is in general conformance with the contract documents, and I'm good with it, right? And it's just as easy as that, right? Probably sat down and thought about it a little bit, but just, you know, put his cover letter on and you're done with it. Maybe there was a deviation. Maybe the bar layout, placement, spacing, size, etc., wasn't exactly as he anticipated, and there was a problem. Now, he could be going back, right, going back to his structural analysis model, updating it, running hand calcs, trying to see could, right, the structural system, all the loads going into the foundation based on the load cases that he deemed appropriate for the project, like, could the foundation that was in place as discovered by you as part of the GPR investigation handle the code prescribed loads and was basically up to standard, right? Maybe that took some time. There were some engineering hours involved. Do you know, Forrest, like, did what the end result of this whole thing was, or was it kind of you gave your report and were moved on from the project?
He wasn't the engineer of record. They just wanted some structural engineer to be out there and oversee it. And I asked the engineer afterwards, like, so, I mean, look, shoot straight with me here. This is really just you slapping your cover page on this, right? He said, yeah, I mean, and he was explaining to me over the phone, why do they want me to come out? There's no value that I can be adding here. I'm not, as you said, the engineer of record. We don't know where that guy is. So it came across as kind of a funny situation. Normally when we do tons of these rebar verification projects, this happens very regularly. And in this particular case, somebody at the county just felt like, you know what? I just want an engineer's eyes on this because it gives me the warm fuzzies, and I just want the warm fuzzies. Maybe they had recently had some problem in the county with where something wasn't reviewed by an engineer and it should have been, so they were just hypersensitive to, like, okay, let's just make sure that if there's an opportunity to get an engineer on site, let's make sure that we're taking that opportunity and, oh, hey, look, this project is coming up. Let's make sure an engineer is out there. That's what it kind of felt like.
And sometimes the engineer is the safety blanket. They make everybody feel good, right? They're licensed. They know, right? They know what they're doing, and it just helps to have that kind of that guiding hand. Now, in this particular situation, the fact that they weren't the EOR and maybe weren't doing anything else besides just observing.
He got some vitamin D that day. It was sunny.
He got to take a trip to the field, which not right. And believe it or not, I know like our industry is different for us, but not all engineers are like get in the field like very much at all. In some cases, right, you are truly behind the desk designing. Other people are collecting information from the field or doing those inspections on site for you, or maybe you're calling you in. There's right now some technology where you can actually have a headset and have somebody observing remotely, and maybe somebody's out there giving them a look, measuring bar, etc. I personally think getting in the field is one of the best things you can do as an engineer, particularly when you're just starting out, which I know our industry gives a ton of opportunity to do, but hey, like could have just been a nice field trip for the guy,
sure,
day, yeah. Half a day, whatever it was, and yeah. just out in the field. And maybe it's just something, right? He wasn't familiar with ground penetrating radar, and he's really got a nice opportunity to learn some new things.
Sure. Yeah. Well, so that's on one end of the spectrum when we're thinking of engineers in the field. Let's go on the end and their relationship with technology. Let's go on the other end of the spectrum, which it sounds like is where you are in terms of technology utilization in performing engineering on site. What types of helps are you having through technology? What is technology doing for you and for the industry that you've seen?
Yeah, and it's a great question for us. And what I'll say is, a lot of the concrete repair and restoration industry, which is kind of where I've been for my entire career, there the way we collect data or collect information from the field in a lot of firms is relatively rudimentary. I was actually brought up with just a clipboard, paper, a pen, and a digital camera. Now I'll start by saying, that's actually very appropriate in some circumstances. It all depends project to project, type, whatever you're doing. But in a lot of cases, there are better ways to do things, right? So inspection software, categorization of defects, automation of counting quantities, et cetera, right? Better creation of plans. A lot of the times we get into situations, as you well know, Forrest, like there are no structural drawings. There's not even just a base map for inspection. So using these tools that we've developed over the years really helps make the process more efficient and allows engineers to spend less time on what I'll call either the mundane or tasks that it doesn't require somebody with a license to do, and then allows the engineers to do engineering.
Right. And so how, that's kind of an area where my company has come in. So I own Enhanced Scanning. We do non-destructive testing services related to ground penetrating radar, utility locating and concrete scanning of various kinds. And not every job, but oftentimes we're sending these results to a structural engineer for them to, for example, assess the, if there's a tenant improvement occurring or some floors added to a building or something like that, and a historic building, they don't know the bar spacing, the bar diameter, really anything about the structure, but what they can see on the surface. Then that's where a company like mine comes in, and we send that information to an engineer, and then they figure all that stuff out. But most of the engineers that I've worked with, and again, this is in the U.S. From what I can tell, this is very different in Europe and other parts of the world, but in the U.S., it seems like it's common for a company like mine, some third party who specializes in some sort of NDT, non-destructive testing, to collect data and then hand that over to an engineer. It sounds like you're in a different situation as an engineer. It sounds like your company almost specializes in the gathering, and analyzing, and then writing a report off of that. How common is it to have the one over the other?
It's a great question for us, and it truly does depend firm to firm. So let's take, for example, what more of your type of work sounds like it consists of, right? So say you're trying to do a renovation on a historic building, maybe you're changing its, you know, the load case from what it was originally designed for. You don't have any drawings or the information you have is minimal. So the structural engineer's time is better spent running the numbers, looking at load cases, interpreting codes to say, hey, this is exactly what we need to do to the structure to make it adequate for use for whatever the end client's need is, right? Well, what do they need? They need information about the structure. And if it's concrete, it's often not very simple to understand certain parameters about the structure that is needed for structural analysis visually, right? And that's where Forest, you guys are a great partner to us structural engineers, because you guys can come in, help us understand, right? How thick is the slab? What size bar do we have? What's the spacing, etc.? And then all that data is then interpreted by a structural engineer to do everything I just talked about. So I'd say that is pretty common, particularly if the structural engineer focuses, you know, on consulting and more of just, right, traditional structural engineering tasks. Now on the restoration side, it's a little bit different because the data collection is quite key to understanding, right, structural response, and because we're often dealing more with like defects and problems rather than, okay, what's the current state of this structure and analyzing it. Having the engineer be in the field or at least overseeing the data collection is important, so they can kind of understand, okay, I saw this defect, right, the root cause is likely this, and that's going to help me prescribe a repair to remedy that situation. But again, you know, we do have some non-destructive testing capabilities in house, but there are some other things, for example, that we would call a firm like yours out to help us out with.
You know, you remind me of a project that we didn't win back. It was sometime last year. This was for it was a car manufacturer, and they had they had taken over this building that used to be, they didn't originally build this, and so they've just renovated this thing, and now they put vehicles, you know, in there on the display floor, and they had a back area that had a lot of their inventory, right? Just cars parked, just stacked next to each other as tightly as possible. And this was a suspended slab. And I believe this used to be, originally, it was a furniture store. So this slab was designed to be holding couches, bookshelves, and beds and things like this. And now they've got all these cars sitting on this. And when you go down in the basement and you look up at the ceiling, there are a number of these cracks in the ceiling right underneath this display floor or the inventory storage area with all those cars parked in there. And so they wanted to understand we were brought in by a general contracting firm who they also had a structural engineering firm involved there. And what we were to do is we were coming up with a proposal for how to determine the health of the slab. We were just going to be doing all the data collection, giving it to structural engineers, and they were going to do their analysis. And what they originally asked us to do is to just kind of come in and just say, like, hey, what can you do for us here? And so so we came in and we developed a plan that was going to be utilizing a number of different technologies. I mean, ground penetrating radar, but then also ultrasonics. We were going to be determining the depth of those cracks to see how if they were very superficial, just a couple of millimeters, or if they went in a couple of centimeters, if they were, penetrated all the way to the bar, and things like that. And then we were also on the top floor going to go through with laser scanning and do a floor flatness, floor levelness report to determine how much this floor is already sagging, if it is noticeably at all, or if, you know, maybe these cracks are just kind of coincidental. Very strong correlation here between cars and cracks, but we were going to do this full analysis. It was actually really exciting. It was really fun. And we came up with a price that I think was very reasonable for how much we were doing on this project. And when they saw the price, they just said, never mind. We're just going to call off the whole project because it was going to be too expensive to figure out if they were about to have a bunch of cars fall through their basement. They'd rather not spend, I don't even remember what it was, $50,000 or $60,000 on the whole thing. And they would just rather save that money. And it was so aggravating that, I mean, not so much that we had spent the time to do it, but that they couldn't see the cost benefit here to spend a little bit of money. Whereas one of those cars, these were electric vehicles, I mean, one of those cars cost three times as much as we were going to charge them. And anyway, I just kind of wanted to vent to you there real quick, Nick. Thank you for listening to me. This has been a great therapy session. How often do you come across things like this that where customers just say like, whoa, we didn't think it was going to cost money to do an engineering analysis of our building or anything. How much does this cost? Why would you charge so much? How often does that happen?
A lot. It happens a lot. And I think, you know, one of the misconceptions maybe is that if work isn't actively being put in place, right, construction, it has less perceived value, which I understand, but there are certain instances where it's unavoidable. And as far as a lot of the technology that you just described, right, are either things that we use or we try to get to an end result that's very similar in our projects. And it's a great use of technology to help engineers make decisions. Just often I would say that maybe they're not as familiar with it, they're not as well equipped to use it, which is why they're going to consult with firms like yours, or they may not even know that it's available and how it can make their lives and the conclusions they come to simpler.
Yeah. Yeah, that was really frustrating. It was frustrating for everybody involved. The structural engineers were they were really put off by this, and the GC, everybody, because they just canceled the whole project.
And that's why it's part of like the qualification process for clients in our business, right? It's just understanding, hey, like, right, us the engineers, we're not so much worried about cost. We're concerned about the health of the structure, but the economics of the situation is always going to be a very real factor. So what we try to do is just upfront say, hey, like, you know, an assessment is on the order of this magnitude. And based on an initial look, right, we may be talking about this other magnitude of repairs. We're not going to give you hard numbers until we actually complete an investigation, get quotes for the work that's to be done. But it's a good gut check to just understand, well, if a $2,000 assessment is too much, we probably just aren't a good fit for each other, and it saves everybody a lot of time. And I don't criticize. I just say, hey, we're not a good fit. We're not meant to be partners in whatever this is. If we just go our separate ways, I think that's more productive than trying to shame asset owners for being cheap or whatever. Because at the end of you don't know all the facts, and at the end of the day, there's always going to be people that need our assistance.
It's frustrating, but it's also I think you're spot on there in terms of ensuring that you're directing frustration in the correct way. That frustration that I felt was initially directed towards this car manufacturer, but thinking about it a little bit, I realized, you know, I don't even know if they own that building. This may be a case where they're taking this and saying like, look, this is more than what we thought. We're going to have to be going through some negotiations with our, with the property owner, and this is going to take a whole long time. And it's often much more complicated than it seems just from the, from the outset.
And let's talk, you know, property condition assessments real quick, because my first thing is if the car manufacturer is renting the space from someone, my first question as the owner is, well, like, how do I know that you didn't cause that problem? Like, where's the proof? And part of a service we offer is like, if, you know, you're taking over a garage or you're buying an asset and you just want to understand what the condition of it is prior to purchase, or maybe you're leasing it and you just want certain things documented and stored for future use, just as a kind of like a CYA, like, and in the garage world, that is also something that we get into and do. So if I was that car manufacturer and I was renting, I would want that thing documented before I moved in, because I don't want it to be a problem. Like all these cracks on the soffit of the slab. Like, was it really the cars, or were those pre-existing? And how do you know that?
Yeah. I mean, that's just like renting anything. That's just like renting a car when you're traveling, or renting an apartment or something. You just document the existing conditions before you move all your stuff in there, before you drive it off the lot. It makes sense. And just getting an engineering firm involved in that is really just, I mean, in terms of the cost of that, that's pennies to the value. The value of that is just huge. Yeah. So with, I wanted to talk a little bit more about the kind of the future of engineering with, you know, we've got the advent of AI doing so much that, you know, I mean, I can't figure out if I would hate being a student in grade school now or love it, because you can have AI just do all your homework for you. Or maybe that would be awful. Obviously, it would objectively be awful. But AI is just playing a bigger and bigger role in more and more professions. What role do you see AI playing with engineering? Is this something that can render some levels of engineering, maybe the tedium in engineering, more obsolete for humans? Or is it something that it really doesn't have an application because X, Y, and Z?
AI absolutely has an application in engineering, but I'll say it, and I say this even on my podcast a lot, is AI is not a replacement for us. It is just supplement or augmentation. And you can look at the codes and the laws, and they'll tell you right there, right? If you need an engineer stamp, guess what? AI ain't signing and sealing, right? And if that's still the case, you're going to need an engineer that's still comfortable and pretty much whatever makes them comfortable. And there's, of course, an economics portion of this too, right? But I see the role of AI as making us more efficient, like you said, removing the tedium and letting us get back to the engineering, less of the busy work, less of the admin type work, and making us more efficient. Now, there are other use cases for, right, strict engineering. I think I just saw, for example, an article on using artificial intelligence to help, I think, quantify concrete strength in testing, or using artificial intelligence to help with, right, defect identification and quantification in concrete structures, for example. So there's all sorts of applications, but when it comes down to it, it's still up to the engineer to determine, right, they're going to be the one that's responsible, and they need to figure out what tools used in what manner work best for their specific use cases.
Well, I think you hit onto a really important word there, responsible, because at the end of the day, the reason why society leans on engineers so much is because we want to know that at the end of some finger pointing, we're pointing the finger at somebody who's competent, and that this guy, the reason why we made these choices is because this competent individual deemed this to be the best design, the best material choice, etc. So there's a lot of pressure on engineers of any sort, because really, unless I'm putting this together wrong, the buck stops there. Everything comes back to the engineer of record and what was determined to be the best design, the best material choice in the beginning there. Does it go beyond the engineer? Because it seems like that's kind of where everything stops.
And so if you get into more of like, so forensics, litigation, construction defects side of the industry, which I've got a little experience in, but by no means would I call myself an expert. It could come from, hey, like, was the design intent that the engineer laid out followed, right? Were there competent people on site that were supposed to be responsible for inspections while the engineer wasn't there? There are a whole host of factors. So in general, yes, like the buck does stop with the engineers, but I mean, like anything in this industry, it's a team effort, right? Like, just because I put some design on a piece of paper doesn't make the building come to life, right? The very skilled craftspeople that actually put work in place, to general contractors who assemble all those craftspeople, to right? Even our admin who just makes sure I know where certain things are on our server, right? Like it's a team effort. So I would generally say that like together we rise, together we fall. So depending on the specifics of any given project or case, there's a lot of nuance, which is why forensic engineers are kind of paid what they are and work the hours that they do. But it is a lot of pressure for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. You're really a wealth of knowledge here, Nick. Everybody should be following Nick on LinkedIn at the very least. Nick, are you active on other social medias also, or is it really LinkedIn the place to see and follow you?
LinkedIn would be the place. I'm looking at other social media platforms. I think, right, like formerly known as Twitter, X has some really great use cases. Instagram, TikTok, if you're into that. Not me personally, but I think each platform does have their merits. So Forrest, I'm trying to figure out what works best outside of LinkedIn.
Well, tell us about your podcast too. What is your podcast all about?
Yep. So we host a podcast, publishes every 2 weeks, and it is called AEC Tech, AEC Engineering and Technology is the full name of it. But it's essentially about the need that I saw it filling was there was a ton of great information and content out there on technology applied to the AEC space, but more for the C rather than the E. And the architects, I think, if I were to order it, I'd say there's more options for contractors, architects, and then I'd put engineers at the tail there. And so we said, hey, as an engineer, somebody who likes technology, I just wanted a place for other engineers like me to be able to come and say, I know I might be interested in something, but I don't know where to start. And come and listen to, you know, we've published about 40 episodes. You may only find one or two useful. That's perfect, right? Take those one or two. Maybe you're talking to the guest of the show. Maybe you're messaging me. Maybe you're looking into the topics that we talked about in greater detail, but it's just providing a central resource for other engineers to come in and learn about technologies that they might not know anything about.
That's really interesting. I think that would fill a very useful need in the AEC industry. And podcasts, I mean, shoot, this is a little self-serving, but I think that podcasts like yours and like mine are very good for the industry to help, you know, you've got this emphasis on helping engineers to get access to the information they need to be more successful. And we try to have a very strong emphasis on helping the new up and coming, you know, professionals in the AEC industry, you know, kind of find their place, figure out what's a good fit, what they should expect. Kind of bringing this to a close here, what advice can you give for somebody who's interested in engineering? Maybe they're in high school, maybe they're well out of high school, but they're just kind of interested in engineering. You've got experience in civil and structural engineering. I imagine you know a fair amount about other fields of engineering. What can you tell a new up and coming individual about what to expect in terms of day to day, and maybe even some warnings, some cautions that you've stumbled through?
Yeah, and I'd say the number one piece of advice I would just give is just sit back, listen, and observe, because what I think I didn't realize coming out of school is that it takes a lifetime to really know your specialty or field of expertise in engineering. And the best thing that you can do is just find someone who's had that lifetime of experience and just soak it all up, right? I've been fortunate. I've had, I'd say, 3 to 4 really, really strong mentors that took a vested interest in me, and I wouldn't be where I am today without them. And in return, and my personal kind of story, and I'd recommend the same, is I just had an aptitude for, right, being creative, using computers, technology, and software in unique ways. And it was like, hey, in exchange for you mentoring me, right, I'm going to do something to just make your day-to-day, make your life easier. So it wasn't just like this one-way street, you know what I mean? And that's kind of how I built my career and got into the position that I'm in today. But hey, if you're, you know, if say you're not fresh out of college with an engineering degree, there are totally options that if you want to be in like the field or adjacent to it, right? There are ways to still get licensed with a 2-year degree. Not as common, but the law says you could do it, and I think that's totally okay. Or if you, you know, hey, you don't have an interest in going back to school, but you want to work alongside engineers. I know, for example, my company has field technician positions where you're doing, right, you're helping engineers with investigative work, you're helping them collect data, you're helping them run analyses, and although you're not like an engineer by like title or license, you're working directly with us doing some of the tasks that make it all possible. And I've met a lot of very intelligent people who have a mind for like engineering or have a mind for like the way a structure acts without the formal training or background. What those people bring to the table is very valuable. And again, just bring all the perspectives in and kind of crafting your own career, I think is pretty important too.
That's great. So, I mean, what I'm hearing from you is that there are a few traditional ways to get into strict engineering roles with a stamp and all, but there are many other methods to be able to, or routes to take to be involved in the engineering fields. And I think that's really cool. That's really neat. Nick, we're going to wrap things up here, but I wanted to thank you for being on to Concrete Conversations podcast, where we help the average Joe become the above average pro. And if anybody wants to reach out to you, LinkedIn is the best way.
That's it. Nick Heim, PE on LinkedIn. Shoot me a message and I'm happy to chat.
That's great. Nick, thank you so much. We sure appreciate your time here on Concrete Conversations podcast, and wish everybody a good day.
Appreciate your time, Forrest, and thank you so much for having me on.
Thanks.